you fly fish. Prior to becoming a super fan of North America's largest rodent, what was your reaction when you'd come across a beaver dam on the trout streams?
Yeah, good question. You know, I think that lots of, like most fishermen, I had some appreciation for beaver. You know, I've certainly caught some big fish in beaver ponds, and I know many of my fellow anglers feel the same way. But you know, they can also be sort of tough places to fish, right? They're kind of mucky. You sink in up to your knees. You know, they're sort of covered in vegetation. So you know, when they're fishable, they're really fun. But they can also be a kind of a pain in the butt.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Ben Goldfarb about his nonfiction book, Eager, The Surprising Secret Lives of Beavers and Why They Matter. Don't go away.
Your book is called Eager, The Surprising Secret Lives of Beavers and Why They Matter. And in the intro, you make a strong case. You write, more than timber, cod, or any other natural resource, beavers helped explain just about every significant American geopolitical event between European arrival and the Civil War. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when the first European colonists arrived here, you know, beaver pelts were probably the most important economic resource. You know, one example is that when the pilgrims arrived, they owed lots of money to their creditors back in Europe. The only way they could repay those debts was by shipping beaver pelts back across the Atlantic. So beavers made the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the Plymouth Colony economically viable. You know, the Revolutionary War, one of the things that angered the colonists was the British denying them access to trapping grounds west of the Appalachians. You know, the Louisiana Purchase was partly fueled by Jefferson's desire to secure more trapping lands. So, you know, there are just so many events that this critical resource, beaver pelts, helped to fuel.
You also write that there were 400 million beavers prior to the European arrival, and by year 1900, there were only 100,000. You call beavers the most triumphant wildlife success stories. So are those two related?
Yeah, so the trajectory for beavers in North America was first catastrophic decline, right? The first for traders and trappers arrived in the early 1600s and immediately set about trapping beavers out of every single river, pond, lake, and stream they encountered. You know, when they first arrived here, we don't, you know, 400 million is sort of a wild guess by early naturalists. Nobody really knows how many beavers lived in North America, but certainly there were many hundreds of millions. By 1900, after three centuries of just unabated destruction, we were down to 100,000 beavers. They'd been wiped out of pretty much the entire northeast of the United States. California, they were completely gone. They'd been really eradicated from most of the United States, and kind of the last beavers in North America were in the Rocky Mountains and in Canada. And you know, fortunately, in the early 1900s, wildlife agencies passed a bunch of laws protecting beavers. You know, there were a bunch of beaver relocations that happened and sort of repopulated this animal throughout the American West. And you know, these days, nobody quite knows how many beavers live in North America, but probably 15 million or so. So, you know, they've rebounded quite spectacularly from that, the kind of the nadir of their population in 1900 or so. But, you know, we still have a really long way to go when it comes to returning beavers to their former spectacular pre-European abundance.
I love how excited you are about beavers.
I get that a lot, yeah.
Yeah. And in the book, you make a note that they're a keystone species. Can you describe what that term means?
Sure. So in architecture, you know, the keystone is sort of the block at the top of a stone arch that holds the entire span in place. And in ecology, a keystone species provides a similar function. You know, it's sort of the critical member that supports the rest of the biological community. And beavers play that role incredibly well. You know, here in the American West, wetlands are only about 2% of total land area, but they support about 80% of the life. So any creature capable of creating those watery habitats, those ponds and wetlands, is critically important. So think about all the creatures that rely on water, you know, from the boreal toads that breed in beaver ponds to the, you know, the juvenile cutthroat trout that rear in them, to the moose that cool off in them, to the waterfowl that nest around them. It's just these are the most important habitats, really, in the very arid American West. And beavers create those kinds of habitats. So they're really these amazing supporters of all kinds of life.
In the book, you also mentioned several beaver facts, my favorite being that beaver fur is so thick that a stamp-sized patch of skin is carpeted with 125,000 individual hairs, more than an average human has on their head. You also talk about the notorious teeth and their tails. Of the latter, you say it's not only a kickstand, but a rudder and alarm system, of course, when they strike in on the water.
Right.
What's your favorite beaver detailer fact?
Oh, man, you named a few of my favorites right then. You know, it's really incredible how well adapted they are to this really unique semi-aquatic lifestyle they have. You know, I love the sort of some of the swimming adaptations. You know, they have a second set of eyelids, a transparent set of eyelids that sort of function like goggles, so they can close their membranes underwater and protect their eyes. They also have a second set of lips. They have a set of fur-lined lips they can close behind their teeth that allow them to chew and drag branches underwater without getting water down their throats. I think that's pretty awesome. And then, you know, there's all the amazing adaptations that come with this really specialized diet they have, right? We know the beavers eat bark. They eat the cambium, which is the inner bark, the kind of the sugary growing layer of a tree. And, you know, that's kind of a very unusual diet, of course. So to facilitate that, they'll ingest and redigest their own poop. You know, they have to extract every last little iota of nutrients. So they'll poop out sort of this black pudding-like substance. Then they'll eat that, and by the time it comes out again, it's like sawdust. And that's just really a tribute to these incredible microorganism communities. The microbiome of the beaver is really specialized and diverse, and they can actually digest cellulose, which we humans can't do.
Probably the most potent, and I might even say pungent, scene in the book is where you're asked to identify the sex of a beaver in the Methow Valley. I'm wondering if you can just give us an overview for the listeners.
Totally. Yeah. I love talking about beaver sexing. So one of the challenging things about working with beavers as scientists is that beavers are basically impossible to visually sex. You can't look at a beaver and know whether it's a male or a female. And the reason for that is that male beavers don't have external genitalia, which makes sense, right? If you're an animal that spends its entire life swimming around log jams and down vegetation, you don't want some little dangling appendage that you can get snagged on things. You know, it's not very good from a kind of a hydrodynamic perspective. So male beavers kind of keep it, you know, all tucked up and internal, which makes it impossible to look at one and know what sex you're looking at. So the only way you can really reliably sex a beaver in the field is by smelling it. Beavers, they're really scent-oriented animals. They have two sets of scent glands. They have the castor sacs, and then they have their anal glands, and they kind of use both glands to mark their territories, and they actually can send really detailed messages to each other, you know, using their scent glands. And they, you know, the kind of the scent secretions encode lots of sophisticated genealogical information. So what you do to sex a beaver, and I have done this, and it, as you say, it's definitely a delicate procedure, is you have to basically sort of rub their bellies until you find the scent organ, and then you sort of squeeze the anal gland, which is one of the scent secreting glands, and then you sort of squirt out a dollop of this scent secretion, which you definitely want to be wearing goggles and have your mouth closed while you sort of milk this gland, and you squirt that onto a tissue, and then you smell the tissue, and if it smells like motor oil, it's a male beaver, and if it smells like cheese, it's a female beaver. And, you know, it sounds unscientific, but actually the people who are experienced at this can basically tell with 99% accuracy whether it's a male or a female. So now everybody listening at home now knows how to sex a beaver if the opportunity ever arises in day-to-day life, which I'm sure it will.
Can you explain the connection between beavers and drought?
Yeah, sure. So there's a lot of beaver interest right now. I think beavers are very hot, and that sort of long predated my book. And the reason for that is that we're recognizing how important these animals can be from a water conservation standpoint, right? We're entering this era of climate change and climate-fueled drought. Of course, our water resources are really stressed, and anything that can sort of conserve water becomes really important. And beavers are very good at that, right? I mean, all of these dams and ponds that they're creating basically function as thousands of little reservoirs on the landscape, right? They're basically slowing water down. So when precipitation falls as rain, you know, it's just going to run off to the ocean, right? But if you've got all of these dams especially in the high country, catching that water, slowing it down, you know, you're basically keeping water in streams later in the year. You know, you're basically holding on to water so that it's there in, you know, August, September, October, later in the season when it's so important. So, you know, you often hear people, especially farmers and ranchers, complaining that beavers steal water, right? That every drop of water behind a beaver dam is one less drop of water for the downstream users. But beavers aren't stealing the water. They're just slowing it down, right? They're basically taking all of these seasonal streams and turning them perennial by holding water back and just delaying its passage downstream. So from a water conservation standpoint, these are really critical animals. And there are all kinds of stories about ranchers using beavers as water source creators for their livestock and people, you know, reintroducing beavers to their property to turn seasonal streams into perennial ones. So these are incredibly important animals as we enter this drought era in the West.
So, Ben, I'm also an angler, and one of the greatest things I learned in reading your book is how to think about waterways. You know, I had this lovely notion of an aerial photograph of these ribbons of streams, and what you have likened it to is a meal of spaghetti with noodles falling off the plate. And I'm wondering if you'll just read a little bit about waterways.
Yeah, sure. Close your eyes. Picture, if you will, a healthy stream. What comes to mind? Perhaps you've conjured a crystalline, fast-moving creek, bounding merrily over rocks, its course narrow and shallow enough that you could leap or wade across the channel. If, like me, you are a fly fisherman, you might add a cheerful, knee-deep angler, casting for trout in a limpid riffle. It's a lovely picture, fit for an Orvis catalog. It's also wrong. Let's try again. This time, I want you to perform a more difficult, imaginative feat. Instead of envisioning a present-day stream, I want you to reach into the past, before the mountain men, before the pilgrims, before Hudson and Champlain and the other horsemen of the fur-pocalypse, all the way back to the 1500s. I want you to imagine the streams that existed before global capitalism purged a continent of its dam-building, water-storing, wetland-creating engineers. I want you to imagine a landscape with its full complement of beavers. What do you see this time? No longer is our stream a pellucid, narrow, racing trickle. Instead, it's a sluggish, murky swamp, backed up several acres by a messy concatenation of woody dams. Gnawed stumps ring the marsh like punji sticks. Dead and dying trees stand aslant in the chest-deep pond. When you step into the water, you feel not rocks underfoot, but sludge. The musty stink of decomposition wafts into your nostrils. If there's a fisherman here, he's thrashing angrily in the willows, his fly caught in a tree. Although this beavery tableau isn't going to appear in any Field and Stream spreads, it's in many cases a more historically accurate picture, and in crucial ways, a much healthier one. In the Intermountain West, wetlands, though they make up just 2% of total land area, support 80% of biodiversity. You may not hear the tinkle of running water in our swamp, but listen closely for the songs of warblers and flycatchers perched in creekside willows. Frogs croak along the pond's marshy aprons. Otters chase trout through the submerged branches of downed trees, a forest inverted. The deep water and the close vegetation make the fishing tough, sure, but abundant trout shelter in the meandering side channels and cold depths. In A River Runs Through It, Norman MacLean captured the trials and ecstasies of angling in beaver country when he wrote of one character, "So off he went happily to wade in ooze and to get throttled by brush and to fall through loose piles of sticks called beaver dams, and to end up with a wreath of seaweed round his neck and a basket full of fish."
If
you're just joining us, that was Ben Goldfarb reading from his book, Eager, The Surprising Secret Lives of Beavers and Why They Matter. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You interview a number of subjects in your book, and one of them says, one of the coolest things that beaver dams do is fail.
Mm.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that was actually, it's actually Becca Levine, who's a geomorphologist, so somebody who studies stream formations, basically, in the Centennial Valley in Montana. And, you know, what she was saying, basically, is that so kind of depends on the place. In some places, beaver dams are remarkably stable. You know, there are places where you can see aerial imagery basically showing beaver dams remaining in a single spot for decades. But elsewhere, you know, especially in the West, where we have these kind of these flashy streams, we have really high spring flows, you know, beaver dams blow out. And when they do fail, you know, they're actually still providing lots of services, right? They're basically deflecting flows, stream flows onto the floodplain. So that's one of the most important things a stream can do, right? Is access its floodplain, is spill onto that floodplain to recharge groundwater, to create those kind of nice, lush, wet meadows that elk and deer and moose love. You know, so they're spilling on the floodplain. They're actually transporting willows downstream, so willows can basically re-sprout. You know, a beaver dam washes out, those willow sticks get deposited along the stream, a ways downstream, and then they take root, basically. So Becca has found that actually lots of the willow in many beaver streams is actually basically being transported from blown out beaver dams. So even when these structures fail, they're still creating complexity, right? I think to me, that's the biggest thing is you said before that, you know, I sort of compare a healthy stream to a plate of spaghetti, right? With lots of threads going everywhere instead of, you know, one sort of clean ribbon, you've got this sort of tangled series of side channels. And that kind of complexity is really important. You know, those side channels are great fish habitat. They're great amphibian habitat. They're great for all kinds of stuff. So I think that's, you know, beaver dams, when they fail, they do still enhance the complexity of a stream. And that's so important for habitat.
Another one of your subjects says, beavers are so simple. I never get angry at a beaver because they never act maliciously, whereas our species is very prone to acting that way. What is it that you think makes beavers enemies to humans?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think the biggest thing is that they're like us in a lot of ways. You know, they're a very easy animal to empathize with. You know, we humans we're driven to change our surroundings, you know, to create farms and build houses and roads and infrastructure, you know, and beavers are driven by that exact same impulse. You know, there are so few animals that actually engineer their own surroundings to maximize their own food and shelter. And you know, us and beavers are sort of two of the world's greatest ecosystem engineers. The problem is that, you know, our vision for the landscape really collides. You know, good beaver habitat is really good human habitat. You know, we both like these sort of low gradient streams, these lush river valleys. We sort of inhabit the same places. But, you know, whereas we're, you know, trying to straighten these rivers and keep them in their channels, beavers are trying to force them onto the floodplain and sort of increase the width of the water. Of course, there are dead and dying trees everywhere in a beaver complex. You know, it doesn't really cohere with our notion of what a healthy, orderly, well-managed system should look like. So I think that's the fundamental conflict, is that we both like the same habitat. We both like rearranging the same habitat, but we have a very different vision for the landscape.
In regard to that, you say humans are fanatical, orderly micromanagers of the natural world.
Right.
We like our crops planted in parallel furrows, our dams poured with smooth concrete, our rivers straitjacketed and obedient.
Yeah, this morning I drove along the Little Blackfoot and the Clark Fork, and you know, you see exactly that. You know, you see these really intensively armored stream banks. You know, these piles of riprap and other sort of mechanisms basically keeping these streams in place. And, you know, of course, that's important because we've filled these valleys with our infrastructure. But, you know, in many ways, our channelization of these rivers has done a grave ecological disservice to these aquatic ecosystems. You know, and beavers, by being agents of seeming chaos, are sort of doing the opposite of that. You know, they're letting rivers spill onto their floodplains. They're increasing complexity. They're turning these straight ribbons into, you know, multi-threaded, really wonderlands of fish and wildlife. So we have very different impacts on the landscape, for sure.
Right. In terms of the paradigm shift, you propose that beavers be introduced like medics deployed into the front lines. Is that how you imagine the future?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a good question what the future holds. You know, I mean, certainly there are lots of places where beavers, you know, are being used like medics, are being relocated or reintroduced in really degraded systems that could use their help. You know, one of the epidemic problems we have in the West is erosion of streams. You know, and what scientists call incision. Oftentimes it's due to beaver trapping or unchecked livestock grazing. You know, we basically lose all of the riparian vegetation along a stream, and you know, there's nothing sort of checking the velocity of the water, and it just carves deep into the bank and basically gets locked between its banks, and it can't access its floodplain anymore. And that's, you know, that's a really negative outcome. And beavers can, you know, can help reverse that to some extent by, you know, by building dams, by slowing the water down, by trapping lots of sediment and rebuilding those streams a little bit. So, you know, I think that's sort of the medic analogy is, you know, we can use these animals in really degraded ecosystems to recover some of that function. You know, whether that's going to happen more in the future, well, I certainly hope so. I mean, beavers are, as I said, they're really hot right now. You know, they're every day it seems like I learn about a new beaver-related project happening somewhere. You know, the Clark Fork Coalition, they're doing a ton of beaver work here in western Montana. So there's lots of great stuff happening. But, you know, there are still lots of social and regulatory obstacles, for sure.
I want to talk about the broader ecological perspective, because, Ben, in the last year, I've had the pleasure of interviewing a number of authors who sort of have this hyper-focus on species. So I've interviewed, you know, about birds. I've interviewed about bears in Mongolia, bears in Italy. You know, I have a mountain lion book on the docket. And there's a part of me that's wondering, why are we splitting off into this sort of hyper-intense focus on individual species? And what is that calling us to do? And how do we reintegrate and weave this stuff back together?
I'm biased, of course, but I think that beavers are in some ways a perfect way to do that. You know, I mean, my book is ostensibly about beavers, but one of the reasons I liked writing about beavers is that it transcends these sort of single species lines, because beavers have such a vital interconnected role in American landscapes, ecology, and history that, you know, you can write about just about anything in the context of beavers, right? I mean, in lots of ways, you know, the history of salmon collapse is a beaver story, you know, in that by trapping out beavers, we destroyed so much of the habitat that salmon depend on. You know, the history of public lands grazing is a beaver story, you know, in that it was unmanaged early grazing that basically made it impossible for beavers to reestablish in many streams. You know, the history of early capitalism is a beaver story, you know, so that's one of the reasons. I mean, you know, no disrespect to bears and mountain lions and other critters. But, you know, I think that beavers, you know, beavers, they just transcend these boundaries in really interesting ways, because they're just so enmeshed with so many other creatures. They're kind of an amazing portal into drought and climate change and flooding and pollution and all of these other topics, because they're such influential landscape scale actors. So, you know, it's a book ostensibly about beavers, but it's really about, you know, why our ecosystems look the way they do, how they've changed over time, and what we can do to get them back to their former health.
The title of your book comes from an idiom, right? Eager beaver.
Right.
And I just want to talk about the play of language in your book. One of the chapters is called Appetite for Construction, which, of course, is a play on Guns N' Roses.
Right.
Appetite for Destruction. We have California Streaming, which, of course, comes from the Mamas and the Papas. What else did I miss, and why did you need to do this play?
Yeah, and Appetite for Construction, all credit goes to my editor there, Michael Matevia. He came up with that chapter title. Yeah, you know, I think that at the end of the day, beavers are funny, right? They're these, you know, they're these sort of strange looking, waddling, fat rodents. Of course, you know, there are so many different connotations of the word beaver. It's just, you know, like I've heard every single beaver joke you can imagine. So, you know, rather than taking a really straight-laced approach to a topic that's, you know, that's kind of inherently amusing, I just felt like I should lean into the comedy inherent in beavers. and, you know, and just have some fun with it. And of course, that's a great way of connecting with readers too. My favorite chapter title, it's a little more subtle, but, you know, there's a chapter in here about the reintroduction of beavers to England and Scotland, where they have Castor Fiber, which is the Eurasian beaver, as opposed to our Castor Canadensis. And that chapter is Across the Pond, which I thought that was a pretty good chapter title. I just wanted to have fun with it and recognize that, look, beavers are inherently funny. And there's also there's something funny too about spending several years of your life, you know, obsessing over a rodent. So I just wanted to lean into it.
And the book inspired me to think about my favorite beaver encounter, which was I was walking in downtown Spokane, Washington one day.
Yeah.
And on a sidewalk, a beaver met me.
What?
Close to the river, and then just slipped into a storm drain. And it stuck with me for, I don't know, it's been 10 years. And I just want to know, Ben, what's your favorite beaver encounter?
Oh, man. Well, I live in Spokane, as maybe you know, maybe not. I live in Spokane, and I have never seen a beaver slip into a storm drain, so I'm very jealous. Although you do see lots of beaver activity along the Spokane River. Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I lived before Spokane. We lived in Massachusetts, and there was a beaver pond near our house in Northampton in western Massachusetts, where the Beaver Lodge had been. It was a massive lodge. It was, you know, like the size of like a, you know, like a basketball court, and the lodge had been in place continuously since the 1950s, is what one local biologist told us. And the beavers there were incredibly well acclimated to human presence, you know, and people would actually come down every evening and they would stand on top of the Beaver Lodge and they would fish off the Beaver Lodge for bass. And, you know, and beaver lodges, of course, attract all this life because they're this structure in the pond. So there's great fishing off this Beaver Lodge. And the beavers were so acclimated and used to humans that they would actually come out and work on their lodge while people stood on top of the lodge fishing off of it. And I thought that was really incredible. You know, here are sort of our two species side by side, you know, sort of both mutually tolerating each other. And, you know, certainly the humans enjoyed the beaver's presence. I'm not sure the beavers appreciated the humans, but they didn't seem to mind.
Ben, is there anything else you want us to know about your book?
Yeah, you know, I think that the fundamental message of the book is basically one of humility. You know, I think that, you know, you read that passage earlier about how we're these fanatical micromanagers of the natural world, right? And you know, I think that's even true when we're well-intentioned. You know, we are sort of these godlike entities, and you know, we have this perception that, you know, just as we sort of screwed the planet up, we and we alone can fix it, you know. And to me, I mean, I think the message is, hey, let's actually outsource some of that labor to this amazing animal. You know, we spend billions of dollars in this country restoring streams and wetlands, you know, using backhoes and bulldozers and front loaders. And, you know, here's this creature that can do a lot of that work, and they can do it better than we can, and they can do it completely for free. You know, again, I think that what I'm trying to say in this book is let's just be humble. Let's embrace this animal. You know, one of my favorite beaver scientists is fond of saying, "Let the rodent do the work," and I think that's a great takeaway.
Ben Goldfarb is an environmental journalist and beaver believer. He lives in Spokane, Washington. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.